When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week, and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Fall into big savings, all in the Kroger app. Buy two, get two free on 12 packs of delicious Coca-Cola, Pepsi, or 7-Up with your card. Then get 3-pound packs of flavorful 80% lean ground beef for $2.99 a pound with your card and a digital coupon. Shop these deals at your local Kroger, less than 5 miles away. Or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Section 13 of History of Rome and the Popes in the Middle Ages, Volume 1, by Hartmann Grisar. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. Chapter 3, Rome's Reverses and the Downfall of the Empire, Part 3. Death of Honorius, Valentinian III and Placidia in Rome. In 410, Alaric's early death in southern Italy relieved the Romans from their terror of his name. His successor, Ataulf, came to terms with Honorius and led the Visigoths into Gaul. At his departure, he was permitted to take with him Galia Placidia, the sister of Honorius, whom the emperor had been forced to bestow upon him in marriage. Ataulf then relinquished the projects he had admittedly long cherished. He had conceived the idea, never dreamt of by Alaric, of founding a permanent Gothic kingdom in Italy on the ruins of the Roman Empire. Instead of attempting this impossibility, he now preferred to lend military aid to the Romans in their wars at the western frontiers. His Visigoths, in conjunction with the Roman legions, were to share the laurels of repelling the incursions of Attila on Gaul. Gradually, the population of the city of Rome returned to its normal strength. Most of the fugitives returned and rebuilt their homes among the ruins left by Alaric. Through the assistance and favor of Honorius, the city for a brief period so far recovered itself that contemporaries who desired to flatter the emperor declared it was even more glorious than before. Among other public buildings, Honorius restored Pompey's Theater, one of the most imposing edifices on the Campus Martius. He thus met the craving for public amusements. It is not so clear whether another public craving, for bread, was satisfied in the same measure. There exists a letter written, circa 414, by the city prefect Albinus to the emperor, in which he notifies that the usual provision of wheat for the people had become quite inadequate, owing to the growth of the population. He therefore proposes that the annona be increased. In the year 417, Honorius himself came to Rome and met with an enthusiastic reception. Perhaps it was then that, feeling the approach of death, he founded the imperial mausoleum near St. Peter's. He and his family were to rest on the spot, hallowed by the tomb of the Prince of the Apostles. This mausoleum took the form of a rather heavy-looking circular chapel, surmounted by a cupola. It stood on the left side of the basilica, close behind the spot formerly occupied by the obelisk. It is identical with the building afterwards, dedicated to St. Petronilla by Pope Stephen II and John I. It survived until the erection of the new church of St. Peter. Having returned to Ravenna, Honorius died while still in his prime. His death took place in August 423, and the directions he left for his burial at Rome were carried out. From a political point of view, the reign of this emperor must be described as a misfortune for the empire. That a boy scarcely 5 years old should succeed him gave prospect of fresh trouble for Italy. Valentinian III, son of Constantius, Placidia's second husband, showed himself from first to last both feeble and changeable. In judgment and in strength, he was lamentably unequal to the burden of difficulties, which are a ruler's lot, especially in times such as his. As Augusta, Placidia assumed the guardianship of her little son and brought him to Rome in order that he might be invested with the purple at the venerable seat of the Caesars, for Rome still anointed the emperor. The officiating bishop was, however, Helion, a Byzantine delegated by Theodosius II, emperor of the East. Theodosius wished the dual empire to be maintained, contenting himself with the Greek throne. The pageant passed off without the result hoped for by the Romans. Their wish was that the city should again become the residence of the ruler. Instead of staying at Rome, Placidia and Valentinian, however, preferred the greater security of Ravenna, with which city Placidia was, moreover, better acquainted. A few years later, a new power made its appearance in the south, a power at whose hands Rome was to suffer indignities even greater than those she had experienced under Alaric. In 429, the Vandals under Genseric crossed from Spain into Africa and then appropriated the Roman provinces, the imperial troops being powerless to stem the savage hordes. During the year 430, the conquerors besieged Hippo, where St. Augustine spent his last days in rousing and comforting the citizens. 9 years later, they were able to occupy Carthage, the capital. Proud of his powerful fleets, Genseric dubbed himself Lord of Land and Sea. At first, he took no steps against Rome. He preferred to wait till her power had been again broken by that dreaded Hun, Attila. Such was the state of Italy that it was a ready prey to the first barbarian chieftain who chose to attempt its conquest. Nor was it devoid of attractions. The actual, as well as the fabled wealth of Rome, exercised an irresistible fascination over these booty-seeking nomadic races. End of section 13. Section 14 of Rome and the Popes in the Middle Ages, Volume 1, by Hartmann Grissar. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. Chapter 3, Rome's Reverses and the Downfall of the Empire, Part 4. Rome's State of Terror under Attila and Genseric. Attila, the scourge of God, had hurled his hordes of Huns across the west, and, allied with the Ostrogoths under Valamir and the Gepidae under Arderic, had penetrated into the heart of Gaul. In the summer of 451, a battle on the Catalonian plains put a stop to their devastating progress and forced the wild warriors to retreat. The military genius of the Roman general, Aetius, backed by the valor of his allied Visigoths under Theodoric, were victorious. After wintering in Pannonia, where he reorganized his shattered forces, the dreaded king of the Huns reappeared in Italy during the spring 452, hoping to compensate himself there for his recently sustained defeat. Aquileia had to bear the brunt of his first onslaught. The fate of this and other cities in Venetia and Aemilia showed the inhabitants of the country what they might expect should he descend victorious into the peninsula. The Roman government was in despair, for Aetius, having neglected to defend the Alpine passes, had no longer any means of offering effectual resistance to the enemy. The road to Rome lay open before Attila. Memories of Alaric and his Goths loomed grimly before the minds of the citizens. They again hastened to hide all their valuables and to seek safety in flight. Even the stronghold Ravenna was threatened, and at one time Aetius actually thought of escaping thence to the east with the young emperor Valentinian. On account of the flagrant cowardice it involved, this plan was, however, abandoned. The first salvation of Italy is one of the most solemn and most celebrated events in history, and is inseparably linked with the name of the great Pope Leo I. All that reliable chroniclers tell us is summed up in the following. The best authority is the Aquitanian Prosper, who inserted his sober statement in his chronicle at Rome itself and during the lifetime of Leo the Great. After prolonged discussion, it seemed best to the emperor, the Senate, and the Roman people to send a deputation to Attila to sue for peace. Relying upon God's help, Pope Leo I accepted this difficult mission and started in company with the consular, Genidius Avienus, the ex-praetorian prefect, Trigetius, and others. They doubtless possessed full powers for making concessions, since it would be futile to rely upon mere entreaties. Leo I was both leader and spokesman, his high character and position fitting him for the task. Of his ability, he had already given proof in previous difficult negotiations. His position as Bishop of Rome was, moreover, one of great influence. When the Emperor Marcian, who succeeded Theodosius II, had invited Pope Leo to come to the East in order to hold a general council against the Monophysites, Leo had refused to quit the city of Rome, alleging that in his judgment, Attila's campaign against Gaul presaged danger and that it was the Pope's duty to remain at his post. Now, however, he willingly left Rome in order to face Attila. The Hun, who was the terror of the world, received the embassy at his camp near Mantua, where the Mincio falls into the Po. "All fell out," says Prosper. As Leo had expected in his reliance upon the divine aid, which never forsakes the pious in their boldest enterprises. This conference with the Pope moved the dreaded foe to compassion. He expressed his pleasure at receiving a visit from the Supreme Pontiff, and after hearing the envoys, he ordered hostilities to cease and promised to make peace with the empire. After this, he withdrew with his forces beyond the Danube. Judging by an excerpt of Priscus the Thracian, preserved by Jordanus, it seems clear that Attila's followers stood in some sort of vague terror of Rome. Alaric's sudden death made many fear that a like fate might befall Attila should he dare to lay hands on the venerable city. According to Hydatius, the Huns, ever since their coming into Italy, had been severely afflicted by God with famine, sickness, and other heaven-sent plagues. If, as is possible, Leo the Great threatened the barbarian king with something of this sort, and with courage and dignity ordered the superstitious monarch to spare the hallowed walls of Rome, broadly hinting at the power of the great prince of the apostles, whose tomb they protected, this would have been in perfect keeping both with his character as a patriot and Christian, and with the situation and requirements of the moment. At any rate, he returned to his flock with the glad tidings that his mission had been a brilliant success. The next matter was to discuss the terms of peace. Throughout these negotiations, two other personages seem to have been particularly active. They are mentioned in Cassiodorus's collection of letters. One was Cassiodorus's own father, and the other was Carpilio, son of Aetius. In detail, however, the progress of events is not clear. Hydatius speaks of military actions undertaken by Marcian, emperor of the East, against Attila's army both before and after the latter's actual withdrawal, but such statements seem contradicted by the reports of Priscus and Jordanus. It is, however, quite certain that in 453, immediately after the retreat had been effected, the whole world was relieved and gladdened by the news of Attila's sudden death. So long as he lived, his terrible spirit of enterprise kept alive the fear of a sudden renewal of his plans against the Roman Empire. The Romans now reaped the advantages of the Battle of Nations on the Catalonian plains and of the concessions from Attila secured by the bishop. These three events, the Battle of Chalons, Leo's peace mission, and Attila's sudden death, united to save European civilization from an overwhelming catastrophe. Had Attila and his Huns succeeded in overrunning the West, all nations would have been plunged into savagery. One shrinks from dwelling upon the fate of Christianity at the hands of such conquerors. Italy and Rome especially could well thank God for their deliverance. Just as the death of Galla Placidia on November 27, 450, gave Attila the signal for his warlike preparations against the Empire of the West, so the death of her son, Valentinian III, brought the plans of the Vandal king, Genseric, to a head. Valentinian was murdered in Rome on March 16, 455, when only 35 years of age, while watching the chariot races on the Via Labicana near Helena's mausoleum. By the aid of his influence and wealth, Petronius Maximus, who had already been consul twice, seized upon the imperial crown and even forced Eudoxia, Valentinian's unhappy widow, to marry him in the first freshness of her grief. But his ambition rested on no firm basis. No sooner did he learn that Genseric had arrived at Portus with an immense fleet and auxiliaries recruited from the African plains and was preparing for an attack on Rome than he deemed it advisable to seek safety in flight. He joined the thousands of fugitives, high and low, rich and poor, who were flocking out of the city, but was murdered and torn to pieces by his own servants. As his corpse, which had been flung into the Tiber, drifted against the vessels of the Vandals, now mounting the stream, the enemy could well congratulate themselves, for they were henceforth undisputed masters of the undefended city. Rome was indeed without the slightest protection against the Vandals. Only her bishop, Leo, remembered his duty, as well as the moral force which he possessed. Having been successful with Attila, Leo was willing at least to make a similar attempt on Genseric. Accompanied by his clergy, he boldly advanced to meet the king outside the Porta Portuensis. The Pope could not indeed hope to arrest the victor, now that his booty was already in his grasp, but by dint of urgent entreaty, he did succeed in wringing a promise from Genseric that no blood should be shed and that the city should not be set on fire. Further, that no one should be induced by torture to give up gold and jewels. The sack lasted a fortnight and was rendered worse by the deliberation and ruthless precision with which it was carried out. All the valuables still preserved in the museums, private houses, churches, or deserted temples had to be helplessly handed over to the plunderers. The imperial palace on the Palatine was rifled down to the copper cooking utensils. Statues of precious metal, standing in the squares or public buildings, which the Goths in their haste had overlooked, or which had been subsequently replaced, fell wholesale into the hands of the Vandal crew. Genseric kept a keen eye upon all artistic treasures, for the barbarian cherished visions of a civilized state in his African dominions, and was desirous of decking Carthage with the masterpieces of foreign genius. Aided by the Moors, his warriors dragged the booty to the numerous vessels which thronged the Tiber, and which later on were to sail down the river to Portus and thence across the sea to Africa. They even mounted the roof of the magnificent temple of Jove on the Capitol and carried off half of the bronze gilt tiles. These were, no doubt, intended for the new edifices of the Vandal capital and may well have been used ultimately for the royal palace Genseric was building there for himself. Since the time of Titus, many of the gold and jeweled vessels from the Temple of Jerusalem had been preserved in Rome. To this day, the triumphal arch of that emperor, with its famous bas-relief, stands to remind us of the victor's progress to the capital with his prize. Perhaps the vessels were still preserved in the Temple of Peace, where they had first been placed. They too went to swell the Vandals' prey. The gilt tiles and the golden vessels of the temple were united in one common doom, relics of the two greatest monuments of Roman paganism and of Judaism. Jupiter Capitolinus, in his day, had proclaimed his victory in the sacred precincts of Judaism, and the Arch of Titus, dominating the Via Sacra and the Roman Forum, with its reproduction of the seven-branched candlestick and the Jewish vessels of sacrifice, still remains as a striking memorial of the overthrow of Jerusalem. Now the hour had struck for the humiliation of Roman paganism in its Idus Iovis Capitolini. Nothing to remind us of its ancient splendor now remains in the eternal city, save a few marble fragments of the building and its hidden foundations. The roof once removed from the Temple of Jove, the building began little by little to fall to pieces and soon vanished completely from history, ancient writers not even deeming it worth their while to mention it. But the spiritual adversaries, who were really responsible for the downfall of paganism and of its god of thunder, have not and never will thus vanish. The religion preached by Christ was destined to survive the successive sacks of Rome, as well as all the other vicissitudes of history. The churches in the city had fallen on an evil day. Generally speaking, they fared much the same as during the sack under Alaric. Only the basilicas dedicated to the princes of the apostles seemed to have been spared, as they had been during the Gothic onslaught. It is, however, likely that the Lateran Basilica, the chief church of the Roman pontiff, also escaped the hardship of pillage. All three churches continued to possess vast quantities of gold and silver plate, even when the days of terror were over. When the storm had passed, Leo I collected the huge silver ewers, which till then had been in use at St. Peter's, St. Paul's, and the Lateran, and, by melting them down, was able to provide smaller vessels for the other Roman churches to replace the plate of which they had been robbed. Six such ewers, so-called metrete or hydrie, were brought from the Lateran, two each from either of the other basilicas. On this occasion, we are told that these vessels had formed part of the gifts bestowed upon these basilicas by Constantine, and that those from the two churches of the apostles each weighed 100 silver pounds. In St. Peter's, a large golden ornamental structure, which Valentinian III had erected over the confessio of the apostle, also survived the storm. It consisted of a bejeweled arcade in which were set images of Christ and of the 12 apostles. Rome's disasters seem to have terminated with the Feast of St. Peter, June 29th, for the more correct chronology places the murder of Maximus on June 12, 455, whilst Genseric entered Rome 3 days later, immediately giving orders for its sack. Admitting that these lasted 14 days, it must have ceased upon June 29th. Perhaps it was owing to the approach of the Feast of St. Peter that Leo the Great was able to obtain from the conqueror a time limit to the plunder. In a later sermon, the Pope said to the people, "The protection of the apostles, Peter and Paul, delivered your city from the bondage into which she had fallen." The word bondage, or as Prosper puts it, bondage worthy of many tears, reminds us of the fact that many thousands of the citizens were dragged away into captivity by the barbarians when they left. The noblest victim was the Empress Eudoxia, who had been seized in the Palatine Palace with her daughters Eudoxia and Placidia. Under the eyes of the trembling Romans, the Vandal fleet, bearing the vast crowd of captives and the rich booty, set sail for Africa. At Carthage, Eudoxia was forced to wed Hunneric, the cruel son of Genseric, and the last three descendants of Theodosius the Great had longed to wait for the day of their release. The Roman spoils became the property of the Vandal capital. At least they remained in Carthage until it, in turn, fell into Byzantine hands, when they were again mostly carried away to the east. The remainder ultimately fell to the Arabs. Of the Vandal fleet, one ship laden with statuary sank in the Mediterranean when on its way to Carthage. In memory of these unhappy weeks of pillage, and because the city had at least not suffered from fire and sword, the Church of Rome, for some years, kept a day of penance and thanksgiving within the octave of St. Peter. Yet the terrible experience was far too promptly forgotten by the main body of the population. It is very characteristic of the superficiality of human emotion, and of Roman mentality in particular, that in the sermon just quoted, where Pope Leo speaks of the capture of Rome, he had already cause to complain of his hearers' neglect of the memorial festival. "How few of you," he says, "came a few days ago to that service which once brought together all the Roman faithful. Your unconcern is a source of grief to me, nay, even of alarm. Is not this forgetfulness a proof that you have not been healed by God's stripes? Or do you not feel bound to return thanks that your well-deserved punishment was so greatly tempered by mercy? I am ashamed to speak of it, but I may not keep silence. The spirit of the world and the devil are served with more zeal than the holy apostles. Senseless theatricals attract bigger crowds than the burial places of our martyrs. Was it, then, circus sports which saved you from falling by the sword, or was it not rather the intercession of the saints? Though we richly deserve God's wrath, we have been spared, but only that we might enter into ourselves and seek forgiveness." End of section 14. Section 15 of History of Rome and the Popes in the Middle Ages, Volume 1, by Hartmann Grisar. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. Chapter 3, Rome's Reverses and the Downfall of the Empire, Part 5. The Phantom Emperors, 455 to 476. Now ensued 2 decades destitute of either glory or peace for the city, during which 8 emperors took their turn in rapid succession. It was the last epoch of the Empire of the West, whose course, guided by irresistible fate, was fast running to its doom. The Germanic race, devoid as it still was of either method or an ordered state, triumphed on the ruins of the Roman world power, and gradually appropriated the heritage of her civilization. After the death of Petronius Maximus, the first emperor to don the purple was a Gaul of Latin descent, named Flavius Massilius Avitus, from Auvergne, or Clermont. He was a well-meaning and also a well-educated man, but he was soon glad to exchange the dignity of Roman emperor for that of bishop of Placentia. In conjunction with Ricimer, who had since won fame as a general and who was related to the reigning family among the Spanish Suevians, the Senate, in 457, raised Julius Valerius Majorianus to the throne. In spite of the promise offered by his wise and firm rule, Procopius even praised him later as the best of all the Roman emperors who ever reigned. He was soon overthrown by the caprice and ambition of the all-powerful Suevian to whom he owed his elevation. Ricimer, the commander of the mercenaries, having now attained the title of Roman Patricius, made emperors at his will. In 461, he honored Livius Severus from Lucania with the crown, but dethroned him after 4 years, and then governed the empire himself. At this juncture, by request of the Roman senators, the Byzantine emperor Leo interfered. Leo was well aware, and wished it to be distinctly understood, that the throne of the Western Roman Empire was by right subordinate to his government of New Rome or Constantinople. It should be made manifest that he, in his own person, represented the unity of the two halves of the great Roman Empire. He sent Anthemius, a Greek, husband of his predecessor Marcian's daughter, to the Latins as their emperor. Ricimer received him quite graciously, and had good reason for so doing. He, the barbarian, was honored by an alliance with a daughter of Anthemius. Servile Rome celebrated, with boisterous rejoicings, the 2 events, the advent of the new Greek ruler and the German wedding. She laughed and was satisfied. But the joy of the Romans was only too soon turned into mourning, for Anthemius, through an unsuccessful and expensive expedition against the Vandals, forfeited popular confidence, and what was worse, also lost Ricimer's favor through adopting an attitude of too great independence. In 472, Ricimer promoted the Roman Flavius Anicius Olybrius to the imperial throne of the West. Anthemius, seeking to maintain his position in Rome by the help of Bilimer the Goth, the luckless city was blockaded and stormed by Ricimer. As if the inhabitants had not already been tried enough, they were now to undergo new afflictions. Ricimer's strongest allies against the besieged city were pestilence and famine. The Germans, encamped outside the gates, at last, with many a feat of arms, carried the Trans-Tiberine side of the city. On July 11, 472, the vengeful Ricimer penetrated into the city proper and abandoned it to his soldiery to pillage as they chose. For the third time within 62 years, the metropolis of the world was sacked by German hordes. The unbridled rapacity of these greedy swarms once more made havoc among Rome's inexhaustible treasures, though very few details exist among the scarce chronicles of the time. History has already cast a shroud over Rome in her decay. Olybrius, Ricimer's feeble puppet, was thus installed emperor by main force. That same year, however, he died of the plague, which had already carried off the mighty Ricimer himself. In spite of his military fame, Ricimer left but an evil memory. His treachery towards his father-in-law, Anthemius, was avenged upon himself and upon the state. Besides this, the fact of his being an Arian made him disliked by the Romans. The last ephemeral emperors of the shattered Western Empire now followed with tragic rapidity. Glycerius was installed by the Burgundian Gundobald, Germans now bestowing the purple as the praetors had of old. This emperor, an honest soldier, but little more, soon shared the fate of Avitus. He forsook a tottering worldly throne for the safer one of a bishop, Salona in Dalmatia was the see to which he was preferred. After him came the emperor Julius Nepos, who retained his authority so long as he was propped up, first by the Byzantines and then by Euric, king of the Visigoths. Euric's presiding genius was Epiphanius, the saintly bishop of Pavia. Epiphanius offers another instance of the growing power of the church, even in the purely political domain. Romulus Augustulus, with his adventurous fate, closes the long list of the Caesars. This little son of Orestes, the Roman general of the German army in Gaul, bore two great names, one reminiscent of the founder of the city of Rome, the other recalling the brilliant builder of the Roman Empire, Augustus. It has often been remarked that history presents scarcely an instance of more bitter irony. Saving the names, the child emperor possessed nothing in common with either of his namesakes, who hover like mournful specters above the grave of the empire. The real ruler was his father, Orestes. When Orestes had been beheaded by the all-powerful general Odovacar, and Romulus Augustulus, after abdicating the throne, had retired into enforced seclusion to the villa of Lucullus near Naples, the history of the Western Empire was at an end. The cross on the coinage under Romulus is as a cross on the tombstone of the empire. Henceforth, no Western monarch, until we reach Charles the Great, will venture to bear the glorious title Imperator. The empire in Italy has made way for the kingdom. Odovacar, a bold and strong barbarian, son of a skier, and formerly in the services of Attila, now, at the invitation of his hordes of mercenaries, assumed the title and authority of king. At Rome, the timid Senate saw no alternative but to confirm the choice of the army. The new king's first act was to compel the state to hand over to his Heruli, Rugians, Turcolings, and Skyres one-third of the public land of Italy. He wished to secure a firm footing for himself and his followers. But this rule by mercenaries, precisely because it was mercenary, could find no welcome in a civilized land. After 13 years of government, by no means devoid of moderation and wisdom, Odovacar had not succeeded in creating a state. His people proved quite incapable of founding a civic community, being warriors and nothing more. From a legal point of view, Italy still possessed her emperor in the east. She still retained her political center at New Rome. Even Odovacar owned the authority of the Byzantine ruler, though in the main, his dependence was purely nominal. Yet we can in no wise overlook that even during those days of humiliation for Italy and for Rome, the idea of a single Roman Empire never lost its vitality. In Odovacar's time, Roman senators expressed themselves in this wise to the emperor of Eastern Rome. Italy wants no more emperors of her own. Let him who reigns in Byzantium be ruler also of the West. The Senate retained its existence under Odovacar, and the other formalities of imperial Roman government were duly maintained. With the consent of the emperor, Odovacar nominated the consuls for the West. Officials were appointed according to the rules in vogue of old among the Romans, and the administrative machinery remained unaltered. Odovacar never called himself either king of Italy or king of the Romans, but simply king, without qualification, for his was not a German kingdom distinct from the empire. Although he bore the title of king, he was really never more than a governor. Strictly speaking, we might describe him as the highest imperial functionary in the Western Empire of that day, his position corresponding practically to the ancient magisterium militiae praesentale. Thus the new kingly dignity found its place among the institutions already in existence. In fact, throughout the development of the new political conditions during the decline of the empire, all sharp changes were avoided as much as possible, and nearly everywhere the deep-laid Roman foundations were visible beneath the new construction. Odovacar was fully aware that he had no right to wear the regalia insignia, the distinctive garb of an imperator, without special leave obtained from the emperor. He had, however, little liking for such display. It is even said that, finding the ornamenta palatii, that is, these very insignia, among the effects left by the Western emperor, he sent them on to Byzantium without a sigh. It is further worthy of note, if we wish to understand his relations with the empire, that during his reign nothing was dated by the year of his rule, the year of the reigning emperor invariably serving this purpose, whereas in the real German states it was usual to mention also the year of the king's reign. This tallies with the retention of the ancient custom of setting up at Rome the emperor's image. It is known that statues of the emperor Zeno were erected during the rule of Odovacar. It is very usual to treat the year 476, when the series of Western emperors terminated, as the beginning of the Middle Ages in the West. For this, there is some justification, but it is by no means quite correct. The collapse of the Western Empire made very little noise. It involved no great change, either moral or administrative. Old chroniclers find scarcely any alterations to record, and barely allude to the end of the Western Empire. The historian Marcellinus alone has thought it worth his while to mention that at that time the Roman Empire of the West ceased to exist. For a further allusion to this event, we have to wait until the end of the 8th century, when it is referred to by Paulus Diaconus. It is again mentioned in the 9th century by the Greek Theophanes. Practically, the Roman Empire of the West had long since been disappearing, as the new races wrenched away, one by one, its provinces. Even in the time of Honorius, this empire was little more than a shadow. On the other hand, the idea of the Roman Empire, one and undivided, still survived in New Rome, now the empire's center. Before, and still more after, 476, this feeling began to spread even, to a certain extent, among the Germans. When Illyricum had been secured by the Eastern power, and Britain, Spain, Africa, the greater part of Gaul, and the countries between the Danube and the Alps had fallen into foreign hands, all eyes turned to the East, and there sought the authentic Roman Empire in the midst of those regions whose center was New Rome. Italy had become a mere appendage and offshoot of the empire to which she was now remitted as a subject. Coins of the period typify the political situation and also the union still in existence. Those from the Empire of Constantinople, some of which we have represented here against coins of Old Rome, have a distinctly Christian character. On some specimens, Old and New Rome are seated conjointly on a throne. These personifications are usually surmounted by the monogram of Christ, or they support a shield on which the symbol of the Christian Empire is visible, thereby signifying that Christianity had given fresh coherence to the empire. The figure of the world-ruling city, Constantinople, either wears a mural crown or a helmet decorated with one, a long tunic or mantle, and the same ornaments and accessories as Roma. In allusion to her geographical position and her command over the straits uniting east and west, the prow of a ship is depicted at her feet. End of section 15. Section 16 of History of Rome and the Popes in the Middle Ages, Volume 1, by Hartmann Grissar. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. Chapter 4. Rome at the Inception of the Germanic and Romance Medieval World. Part 1. The New Nations. The period marked by the extinction of the Western Empire and the reign of Odovacar seems to invite a compendious review of the rising German world, which Old Rome on the Tiber and, to a lesser extent, New Rome on the Bosphorus will soon be called upon to supply with culture and civilization. Odovacar's kingdom had in the north unsettled and unruly neighbors in the Alemanni, the Thuringians, and above all, the Rugians. The Alemanni gradually extended their sway up the Rhine from Maguntia, or Mance, into the German highlands, on the one hand to Augusta, or Augsburg, and on the other beyond Brigantia, or Bregenz, and Visontio, or Besançon, and even threatened to absorb the whole Roman province of Raetia. The Rugians had, indeed, none of their stability and organized force, but they made ceaseless inroads upon Roman Noricum, devastating it with fire and sword. These are the barbarian incursions which are so vividly portrayed in the life of St. Severinus, the apostle, savior, and consoler of the Roman inhabitants of the region. Pannonia, the adjoining country, had been given over to the Rugians, the Heruli, and the Ostrogoths. The valiant Ostrogoths were at that time settled in Moesia, but will soon advance thence under Theodoric to begin their glorious but unhappy career and to make themselves masters of Italy. Far to the north, between the upper course of the two rivers, the Oder and the Vistula, we find the Lombards, also future guests and conquerors of Italy. Their occupation of the country was to be far more permanent and influential than that of the Ostrogoths. In the south and on its western frontier, Odovacar's kingdom had a dreaded foe in the Vandals. Their rule extended over northern Africa, Corsica, Sardinia, and even over the western portion of Sicily until Odovacar succeeded in driving them out of the latter island. Strange as it may sound, considering the bad character with which the Vandals had been branded by history, in their form of government, they approached more than any other new nation the methods of the Romans. In Roman Africa, they retained the whole hierarchy of Roman functionaries, and at their capital, a Roman, a vir spectabilis, was appointed proconsul for the city and district of Carthage. At the royal palace, there was even a referendarius. The whole of Spain, except a few strips of coastland in the south, and the northern part down to the lower course of the Tagus, belonged to the Visigoths. In the latter district, the Suevi had established a kingdom. The Visigoths, who were the most powerful and the best disciplined of the new nations, had also overrun the so-called Provincia, or Provence, on the northern side of the Pyrenees, as well as Narbonne and Novem Populanum. The rule was acknowledged throughout Aquitania, as far as the banks of the Liger, or Loire. Their most important cities were Biturrigae, Pictavium, Bertigallia, and Auvernay. That is Bourges, Poitiers, Bordeaux, Clermont. But their headquarters was Tolosa, where their new king, Euric, kept his court. A contemporary, Sidonius Apollinaris, describes in poetic fashion how, in this city of the mighty prince Euric, all the other Germanic states were represented. There comes the blue-eyed Saxon, accustomed to the sea, where his ships rove through the northern waters. He feels uneasy when on land. There thou may seest the Sigimer, or Frank, with his long hair thrown back from off his temples. There is a Herulean whose complexion reminds one of the waters of his country. The huge Burgundian, towering 7 feet high, sues for peace on bended knee, and the proud Ostrogoth seeks for help against the Huns. Even thou, O Roman, comest too, to beg for aid against the Scythian. Yea, the powerful Garumna shall protect the feeble Tiber. In this picture there is some historical truth. Apart from the characterization of the various tribes, the allusion to the attitude in those days of the kingdom of Burgundy towards Euric is worthy of remark. Burgundy possessed vast resources and important cities, such as Lugdunum, Vienna, and Augusta Donum, that is Lyon, Vienne, and Autun. Nevertheless, it had submitted to the Visigoths and acknowledged their supremacy. Yet it was not the terrible Visigoths, but the Franks, who were eventually to sway the destinies of Gaul and Germany. Out of the original Frankish settlements in northern Gaul and on the lower and middle Rhine, Clodovec, or Clovis, whose reign began in 481, formed his powerful kingdom. Previously, during the middle of the century, the Franks were still allies, or foederati, and subjects of the empire. Indeed, all founders of Germanic states began their careers as Roman generals, who had associated their people as allies to the empire. Their development into independent governments took place gradually, and Roman influence continued for a long time predominant. The Roman Syagrius, who maintained the last vestige of imperial power in the district between Aurelianum, Parisii, and Suessiones, that is Orleans, Paris, Soissons, was vanquished by Clodovec in the year 486. After this, the Frankish king successfully engaged and overthrew the Alemanni and finally made an end also of the power of the Visigoths in Gaul. Through his memorable conversion to Catholicism and by inducing his pagan followers to follow his example and seek baptism, he cleared the way for the future progress of Frankish civilization. The respect and consideration shown towards Roman institutions secured the stability of his life work. Both these influences, even more than his ever victorious sword, helped to settle permanently the predominance of Frankish power. The Franks alone were destined to maintain their ground as a nation all through the Middle Ages, when the rest of the Germanic races sank into insignificance. It was this same power which in due time re-established the empire in the person of Charles the Great, and the new Christian empire was ordained to be a second pillar of Western Christian civilization, side by side with the Roman papacy. If we seek in the middle of the general commotion of the 5th century for a grand turning point in history to mark the commencement of medieval times, the rise of Clodovec, and especially his baptism as a Catholic, seem in many ways far more epoch-making than the event of 476. What was then enacted among the Franks had a far deeper influence over the development of the world than the vanishing point reached by the old Western Empire. It marks the beginning of a new era, not only outwardly, through the political changes by which it was accompanied or to which it conduced, but from a moral point of view, through its lasting consequences for civilization. Whilst the Franks thus entered the church directly, without having been misled into Arianism, all other Germanic races, in abandoning heathenism, adopted the Arian tenets. Arianism proved itself a very serious hindrance to the healthy social and political progress of these infant states. The Arian sect was feeble and lifeless, the teaching of its bishops and priests being productive of very little results among the people. Their religious views were not very far removed from heathen polytheism, for they only nominally confessed and revered the divinity of the Son and of the Holy Ghost. In reality, they subordinated both to the Father. By thus considering them as beings of different rank and importance, they certainly came very near to the idea in vogue among cultured pagans, quite apart from the superstition attached to their worship of these highest beings. Moreover, Arianism was entirely deficient in unity, either internal or external, and with its want of cohesion, could oppose no resistance against outside attack. It was serviceable as a vague and accommodating state religion, but it could strike no deep root in the heart, still less imbue the life of whole nations with the impetus peculiar to religious enthusiasm, with virtue and the spirit of self-sacrifice. The wide gulf was very marked which Arianism had created between the Latin Catholic races and their Germanic conquerors, who had from their very cradle imbibed this heresy from the then Arian Byzantium. The earlier Catholic inhabitants were not only prejudiced against the religious beliefs of the new ruling races, but also, not unnaturally, against their social habits, and avoided all intercourse with them. The conquerors, on their side, mistrusted the vanquished. A fusion of races seemed hopelessly impossible. Yet since the conquerors were devoid of culture, they were compelled to seek instruction from their subordinates. An exchange of ideas was imperative if the nations were to make any real progress, whilst wherever Arianism prevailed, this remained either impossible or else very difficult. The conflict of doctrine even led occasionally to sanguinary persecutions directed against the Catholics. These were especially frequent and fierce among the Vandals under Hunneric. But even the Visigoths, before their conversion to the Church of Rome, had poured out in streams the blood of their Catholic subjects. The German persecutors were stimulated by a wish to institute a national church entirely subservient to the government. As Arianism was ready to conform, whilst Catholicism by its very nature and its connection with Rome was opposed to any such measures, Catholics had to be converted to Arianism by fair means or foul. We all know how heroically thousands of martyrs in North Africa endured death rather than conform with the orders of the Vandals. The situation was wholly different in the kingdom of the Franks, admitted into the living union of the Catholic Church, without having passed through Arianism. This strong and gifted race acquired elements of spiritual culture, which strengthened it yet more for its work in the future. Of course, prolonged social discipline was required to enable the Franks to accomplish their allotted task of grafting Latin culture on the German temperament. This was a work of centuries. Often during their progress, both people and purpose seem likely to be overwhelmed, either by the adverse influence of uncontrolled national liberty or by the quarrels and ambitions of their kings. The two enemies which mainly hampered the Franks in their struggles to attain their ultimate position in relation to Rome and the Western Church were an inordinate sense of personal freedom pervading all classes of the people, and the restless aspirations and selfish intrigues of the Merovingian princes. In both these directions, the Church had to work ceaselessly and patiently. Within wise limits, however, this sense of liberty, coupled with royal authority, were two new and healthy elements imported into the effete ancient world, and as we said previously in a different connection, it was in the very nature of the Church to support authority and freedom, provided that both were restrained within due bounds. Nor was it long before the new nations, and more especially the Franks, felt the benefit of their national characteristics. The principles brought into practice by these new nations made fresh blood course through the veins of mankind. Take first the noble German aspiration for freedom. Under the Roman system of government and jurisprudence, individual liberty had never been fully recognized. The servile bureaucracy of the late Roman period had reduced it almost to a dead letter. Early medieval legislation, however, allowed it a much wider scope. Likewise, within the power of the crown, the imperator of the Romans had been an absolute autocrat. On the other hand, from the outset, the Middle Ages recognized a plurality of coexistent independent and rival sovereigns, the authority of each being enhanced by the cross which he bore among his insignia. Under these manifold scepters, whose subjects formed one vast Christian family, the national characteristics of each country developed in a manner never dreamt of in the Roman state, with its rigid ideal of enforced equality of laws for all. Such were the new nations which took possession of the provinces of the Western Roman Empire. Our hasty sketch may serve to show some of the shortcomings and also some of the good qualities observable among them. End of section 16. Section 17 of History of Rome and the Popes in the Middle Ages, Volume 1, by Hartmann Grissar. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. Chapter 4. Rome at the Inception of the Germanic and Romance Medieval World, Part 2. Roman Culture and the Barbarians. Rome and Italy, abandoned to Odovacar's Arian and heathen hordes, became subjects, as we have just seen, of the barbarian kingdom which succeeded the empire. This was a disgraceful position for the ancient metropolis of the world. It was still more unnatural that Rome should be forced to endure conquerors professing a strange faith, for these barbarians were all Arians, except such as were still pagans. Every devout Roman attached to his church must have experienced deep sorrow at seeing the services publicly performed by Arians in the holy city of the apostles and the martyrs. A church still exists at Rome belonging to that period of foreign Arian domination. This is St. Agatha in Suburba, also called the Church of the Goths, founded and decorated by Ricimer. It is a perfect specimen of a small Roman basilica of that epoch. A large mosaic, also due to Ricimer, represented Christ seated on the orb and surrounded by his 12 apostles. It adorned the apse and existed, together with Ricimer's inscription, until 1589, when it was destroyed. Gregory the Great reconsecrated this church for Catholic worship at the beginning of his pontificate, 590-604. From his account of the dedication, we easily discern the dislike and distrust felt by the Romans for the places of worship of these foreign heretics. Cultured and patriotic Romans could not fail to view with deep anxiety for the future these new kingdoms and the ruin of the ancient empire of the West. Many had no hesitation in proclaiming aloud the whole Roman Empire was coming to an end. Some must have felt cruelly the refusal of Honorius to countenance in 404 the celebration of the Ludi Secularis, those time-honored games which had commemorated ancient Rome throughout the period of the Republic and of the Empire. The poets of the period only expressed the general feeling when they declared that the age had come of the 12 vultures Romulus was said to have seen. Both the pagan writer Claudian and the Christian Sidonius Apollinarius applied the fulfillment of the legend to their own time. According to the augur Vettius, also quoted by Varro, the kingdom of Romulus would endure for 1,200 years, then new rulers would arise. Doubtless visions of the German conquerors in the provinces floated before the Christian poet Sidonius when, in his address to the emperor Avitus, he exclaims in these words, "Already we have heard the rustle of the 12 vultures' wings. Rome, thy doom approaches fulfillment. Thou knowest thy sufferings." No literary productions of that period give us better insight into contemporary opinions on Rome and the ordeal awaiting her civilization, and into the condition of the Germanic races, than these writings of Sidonius. He is a hearty champion of Roman culture among the barbarians established in the empire. Sidonius, the Gaelic poet and future bishop of Auvergne, or Clermont, in his address to Avitus, makes the gods hold solemn counsel. The description is full of classical allusions. In fact, it is a good specimen of the bad taste and pedantry then prevailing in the schools of rhetoric. Jupiter, the father of the celestials, seats himself upon a throne surrounded by his court. Roma appears before him, and in a long-winded speech, he announces that the 1,200 years predicted to Romulus are almost at their term, but that he intends renewing her youth. She will become more glorious and more magnificent than ever, because, forsooth, of the marvelous reign of the emperor Avitus. On this announcement, poor Roma is, of course, overwhelmed with the congratulations of the assembled Olympians. In this artificial production of the poet, what most concerns us and our subject is the sad and dejected figure of Roma. Here, with the troubles of the time yet fresh in his memory, Sidonius speaks with greater truth and feeling than elsewhere. According to him, the goddess Roma comes before Jupiter, weighed down with sorrow, and scarcely able to crawl. The helmet has been torn from her brow. Her hair falls tangled and bedraggled down her back. Even the shield which she still holds seems beyond her strength to support, and she well knows that the old spear which she carries in her hand has long ceased to inspire terror. With sobs she begins to lament that all-powerful fate has been too strong for her. The protecting roof under which she had once gathered all the peoples of the world is now giving way above her. Sidonius, as a Gallo-Roman, and in consequence of his high position under the imperial government, was imbued with the strong spirit of Roman patriotism. In his poems, he shows a certain preference for depicting Roma in all her pristine power. In two passages, he gives full details of her appearance and of her significant emblems. His descriptions exactly recall the conventional artistic type by which Roman sculpture represents Roma as the symbol of universal dominion, as the goddess who in heathen times had been worshipped in her temples as the personification of worldwide power. If, however, we may apply a scientific standard, Sidonius's description does not tally precisely with any actual portraiture of Roma in antique art. Many such types have been preserved, and they have been classified by archaeologists in order of their development and according to their varieties. Sidonius takes the liberty of adding to the type of Roma, usual after Hadrian's time, certain earlier details, or such as were less frequently in use in imperial times. On the other hand, strange to say, though a Christian, he quite omits the monogram of Christ, the distinctive symbol of the Christian empire, from the attributes of Roma, though during the period subsequent to Constantine, this emblem almost invariably made its appearance in personifications of the city, such, for instance, as we find upon coins. As depicted by Sidonius, Roma is frankly pagan, and this detail, though seemingly unimportant, is very characteristic of the literary views and customs obtaining among these Christian Roman authors. Having regard to the general scheme of the present work, we feel justified in describing her and casting one more retrospective glance over classical antiquity. The poet represents Roma, all-powerful and triumphant, in the garb of a warlike Amazon, in short tunic, buckled only over one shoulder. The helmet towers above the mural crown and wreath of laurel. Her hair falls in masses over her back and shoulders. Below the knee, her legs are bound in the straps and chains of the cothurnus. A sword, ornamented with boule, dangles from her belt. Her trusty spear is made of ivory tipped with bronze, while the mighty shield borne on her left arm displays the metal figures of Romulus and Remus, suckled by the wolf, as well as Mars and Rhea Silvia, from whom they claim descent, and Cupid and the Tiber. Thus attired, Roma is seated on a rocky throne, while beside her, the war goddess Bellona hangs upon the trunk of a mighty oak, those trophies of which Rome had despoiled the nations. The overpowering majesty of the figure, finally remarks the poet of his own production, is enhanced by her chaste dignity, and even more impressive than her peculiar beauty is her force and warlike strength. Gaius Solius Apollinarius Modestus Sidonius, to give him his full name, was born at Lugdunum, or Lyon, and was grandson of an imperial prefect of the Praetorium for Gaul. His poems, and still more his letters, are a perfect mine of historical information. As a typical representative of the Latin classicism of his day, though he draws largely on Christian thought, he allows all the creations of his pen to talk in pagan fashion. He sacrifices everything to style. So enamored is he of the defects and affections of the decadents that he is quite unconscious of the emptiness of his mythological imagery and of the questionable taste of his wordplay and poetical artifices. His chief models were the pagan poets Statius and Claudian. His devotion to pagan classicism has even led some to suspect that he was little more than a nominal Christian. This was, however, not the case. His apparent paganism was all outward form. At heart, Sidonius was a good Christian. When, after an adventurous life, this experienced man of the world was chosen bishop, he at once renounced as worldly his poetic work and devoted himself exclusively to the welfare of the semi-barbarians entrusted to his care. He feared being accused of levity, did he devote his time to frivolities instead of busying himself in the sacred duties of his office. He must not now, as he says, mar the grave dignity of the cleric by praising men in verse. In future, he will confine himself to singing occasionally the glory of the martyrs, who at the price of their blood bought the everlasting reward of life, and to praising the heavenly mediators, whose help during severe trials he has himself experienced. Many of his earlier poems he would fain see destroyed. The effusions of this late Gallo-Roman are not to be compared with the poems of the Christian singer Prudentius. Prudentius escaped the influence of the decadence in literary taste. Through the works of this dignified Spaniard, there flows a current of deep feeling and genuine enthusiasm. A similar difference exists between the letters of Sidonius, though these are more sober and informing than his poems, and those left us by certain earlier ecclesiastical writers. They are, for instance, immensely inferior to the letters of St. Jerome. In force and feeling, our Gaelic rhetor falls far short of this early father, who was himself no mean classical scholar. We can only regard that classical culture was brought before the new nations under such an unnatural disguise. Vapid outpourings such as those of Sidonius could have but little attraction for these children of nature. In the schools of southern Gaul especially, grammarians and rhetoricians stubbornly strove to preserve all the traditions of this fast-disappearing Roman classicism. Of these schools, Sidonius was a pupil. Eventually, his poems were adopted as models for a sort of learned Christian poesy, and thus he at least served as a link between classical literature and culture and the poetry of the new nations during the Middle Ages. Whilst the epistles of Sidonius give us a vivid picture of the state of civilization in the empire at its decline, his life and sphere of action afford a certain insight into the intellectual and spiritual conditions then prevailing at Rome itself. No one had been more ready with panegyrics for each rapidly succeeding emperor than he. No one could more easily adopt new views. It was almost indifferent to him whether the new and the old emperors had been friends or foes. These fulsome panegyrics brought him into high favor, and that was all he cared about. For having, in 456, extolled the consulship of his father-in-law, Avitus, now emperor, and described the assembly of the gods, and Roma's rejuvenescence through the reign of the new ruler, he was rewarded by having his statue erected on Trajan's forum. With great complacency he penned, in sapphiric verse, an account of this grand event to his friend Firminus. Nerva Trajanus, he tells him, looked down upon the statue bearing the name of Sidonius, which it had been found fit to erect in the Forum Traianum, amidst the monuments of the authors of the works preserved in the two libraries nearby. To another friend, Valerian, he writes in hexameters that at that memorable moment, the Portus Ulpia had sparkled with the bronze of Sidonius. This same poet was also lucky enough to gain the good graces of the succeeding emperor, Majorian, by a panegyric on his second consulship. In this one, we hear Vandal Africa imploring help of the goddess Roma, and in answer, aid is promised through the invincible emperor. When later Athemius became emperor, he too received a poetic tribute in which the inevitable Roma once more appears on the scene. She is hastening to the east in search of the Greek Athemius, who is to be the savior of Italy. This last poem, which Sidonius, as usual, recited publicly before its hero, was the means of raising him to the dignity of city prefect. As the poet himself phrases it, "The people of Quirinus and the purple-robed senate had wreathed a double crown of bay upon his brows," that is, voted him a statue on Trajan's forum and then made him prefect. Our energetic Gallo-Roman was ultimately to deserve a more enduring crown through his conduct as Bishop of Avernus, to which see he was elected about the year 470. In this position, he was not only successful in elevating and improving the population from a religious point of view, but also, through his powerful guidance, in supporting and shielding them during times of war and turmoil. His foresight and energy long protected the town against the assaults of the Visigoths. Sidonius thus enables us to realize the active part taken by educated Christian Romans in the social and political life of the new states. The bishops of all of them belong to old Roman families of the conquered provinces. During those unsettled times, all the advantages they derived from their education and their religious position were used for the good of their flock. They saw to the defense of their cities, and when necessary, went as envoys to treat for peace. But what was yet more, and in this, Sidonius was eminently successful. They softened rough natures by the power of religion. They broke the bread of faith to the ignorant, and taught those whom the difficulties of this life had rendered desperate to tread the path leading to the eternal life of heaven. It was this religious teaching which formed the strong point of their educational system, not speeches and poems, not literature and art, not any form of mere worldly instruction. End of section 17. Section 18 of The History of Rome and the Popes in the Middle Ages, Volume 1, by Hartmann Grissar. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. Chapter 4, Rome at the Inception of the Germanic and Romance Medieval World, Part 3. Roman Buildings, Their Alleged Destruction by the Barbarians. Since ancient times, a curious delusion has existed, and still exists, among ill-informed people, that the monuments of ancient Rome owed their destruction to the barbarians, the Goths, Vandals, or other new nations. For centuries, popular tradition in Rome has repeated this legend, and people have railed against hate, envy, and wanton destructiveness of these northern conquerors. Yet it can be proved that this childish opinion was only formulated towards the end of the Middle Ages. It was the merest fancy, but the early writers of the Roman monuments, the so-called antiquari of the 15th and 16th centuries, accepted this tradition without question and repeated it in their writings. Thus, in a little book entitled Antiquities of the City, 1527, a Roman, Andreas Fulvius, saw fit to recount with much indignation how the barbarians had greedily carried off, one after the other, beautiful monuments and buildings, how they even dragged away the marble or burnt it for lime, breaking up or carrying off the inscriptions, that posterity might know nothing about these monuments and their fate, where the buildings were too substantial for them to give free play to their love of destruction. These grudging enemies of Rome's fineries strove to deform and deface them to the best of their power. Even the famous Raphael Sanzio shared this belief of his age. In a letter to Pope Leo X, he accuses the Goths and Vandals of having outraged the monuments of the Queen of the World. Still, he has sufficient sense of justice not to forget the delinquencies in this respect of the medieval Romans, and even to condemn the reckless conduct of his own contemporaries toward the monuments of antiquity. We have only touched upon this subject in order to show that it is a perfect anachronism to speak of Rome being destroyed during the 5th or even the 6th century. The destruction of ancient Rome was the slow work of later centuries, beginning perhaps about the 7th and lasting to the so-called Renaissance, and even well into the latter period. The barbarians, Alaric and the Vandals, and the subsequent Ostrogoths, never destroyed the city, but were mainly content with its plunder. Their eyes fastened on the accumulations of gold, silver, and other valuables, on choice statuary and movable artistic treasures of all sorts. We saw indeed that under Alaric, several buildings were either destroyed or damaged by fire, but it is a far cry from the rough work of robbers, even when their blind rage turns to incendiarism, to the complete or partial destruction of a huge metropolis of marble palaces. It is almost comic to picture these greedy booty seekers forgetting, according to the legend, all that they were in search of, and turning in sheer spite to the demolition of stone walls and blocks of towering structures, and casting down in the nick of time buildings which had taken thousands of men long years to erect. It should have been borne in mind that these Goths and Vandals had a much pleasanter and much less exhausting task in pillaging the wealthy city. As early as the 16th century, old Petrus Angelus Bargeus expressed his astonishment at the existence of such a tradition. After examining the charges, he benignly absolves the barbarians from the imputation. Among other reasons, he observes that Gregory the Great, who was himself a Roman, when speaking of the decay of the city monuments, makes the elements and not the barbarians responsible for it. Besides the elements and the heavy hand of time, there was a still stronger destructive influence at work on the buildings of ancient Rome. This was the prevalent bad habit of using the materials of the old mansions, theaters, temples, etc., in the erection of new structures, sacred or secular. To this we must add the many medieval fights for the possession of the city strongholds, which had been mostly erected inside ancient buildings, and the haphazard excavations undertaken in search of treasure, where want of caution resulted in much needless damage. Many other individual causes we cannot here enumerate. In the 6th century, the Greek Procopius praises the care bestowed upon their splendid ancient edifices by the Romans. "I know of no city," he says, "which equals Rome in anxiety for the preservation of her ancient adornments. Although she had to suffer so severely from the barbarians, she contrived to retain her buildings safe and sound. She can display whole avenues of artistic structures of such enormous size and strength that neither time nor neglect could affect them. Monuments are still standing in the city, which recall the period of her foundation." A succession of imperial edicts provided for the architectural preservation of Rome. Their enforcement devolved upon the city prefect, who, by imperial appointment, was not only head of the Senate and supreme administrator and judge, but also, at the time of which we write, the highest official resident at Rome. According to the official list of the later empire, Notitia Dignitatum, he had under him, for the management of public buildings, a curator operum maximorum and a curator operum publicorum. Further, a special curator statuarum, a comus formarum for the aqueducts, Acomus riparium et alveae Tiberis et cloacarum, to care for the riversides and sewers. To add to these, a special consularis aquarum, and for the landing stages and river traffic, Acomus portus and a centenarius portus. Moreover, for the warehouses or emporia on the Tiber, a curator horaeorum galbaniorum, not forgetting the tribunus riborium nitentium, or chief commissioner of the police for general cleanliness. There was, therefore, under all-embracing Roman administration, no lack of functionaries for taking care of the city and its dignity. Yet already many liberties began to be taken. Decaying edifices were often despoiled of their stones or ornaments for the benefit of buildings or repairs in progress elsewhere. This was, however, nothing new. Both Diocletian and Constantine, from motives of economy or haste, had used old materials for their new constructions. In the Code of Theodosius and in that of Justinian, under the titles of De Operibus Publicis and De Operibus Privatis, we find it repeatedly forbidden to enrich new buildings at the expense of ancient public edifices. A law of the emperors Valens, Gratian, and Valentinian, 376, ordains, whosoever wishes to erect any new building in the city must procure his own materials. He is not at liberty to use everything which happens to come handy, to dig up the foundations of famous monuments, nor to cut anew stones taken from public structures, nor to deface public buildings by appropriating thence blocks or slabs of marble. The same law, moreover, very wisely prohibits the construction of any new public buildings without real reason or necessity. Now that the seat of government had been transferred to Constantinople, there was at Rome a surplus of public edifices. In fact, they were so numerous that their upkeep proved very expensive. Let no city prefect, runs the edict, or other high official erect any new building in the noble city of Rome, or Roma Inclita. His care will better be directed to the restoration of ancient edifices. According to the tenor of this law, the taxes collected annually for building purposes were to be devoted to the preservation of existing monuments. Another protective enactment was issued by the Emperor Honorius to safeguard the heathen temples. This, however, left a loophole for abuse. It conceded that at least such structures, sacred or profane, as were already quite in ruins, or served neither to adorn the city nor for the benefit of its inhabitants, might be put up for sale. Experience soon proved that people were disposed to stretch very far the license thereby granted. One of the last of the nominal emperors deserves credit, both for having stopped the abuses to which the law of Honorius had given rise by abolishing its concession, and for having adopted strong measures to ensure the preservation of the city, and this at the time when the authorities generally were totally oblivious of previous decrees to this effect. We allude to the high-minded emperor Majorian. His edict clearly shows on whose shoulders must be laid the burden of the blame for having commenced the demolition of Rome. He therein states that he has been deeply concerned to learn that, with the sanction and approval of the government, public buildings have been destroyed. The magnificent legacies of antiquity have been robbed, and people have excused themselves by saying that the stones were required for repairs, petty structures being restored at the expense of the great. People are even beginning, and this with the connivance of the city fathers, to erect private dwellings with materials taken from public buildings. He has accordingly been induced to make it a general law that no one shall dare lay sacrilegious hands on the temples or any other monuments. Should any official of higher rank sanction such a proceeding, he shall be mulcted in a penalty of 50 pounds in gold. Subordinate officials, apparitoris et numerari, proved accessory to such dealings, shall be scourged and have the hands cut off which they have raised against the heirlooms of former ages. This drastic law, though hardly ever enforced, shows us that Majorian was in grim earnest. Incidentally, it also throws a very vivid light on the then state of Roman officialdom. The punishments threatened in the last clause were, however, by no means of unusual severity. With regard to the buildings, continues the emperor, which private persons have hitherto despoiled, nothing further may now be carried away. Everything reverts to the state. For the future, he cancels all authorization to alienate ancient buildings. If any edifice must be removed, either because it is beyond restoration or because the site is required for other purposes, then the matter must be submitted to the Senate, which shall in due course acquaint him with its decision in order that he may do as he sees fit and authorize the materials to be used for adorning some other structure. Among other reasons, Majorian based this law of 458 on the respect due to a venerable and beautiful city. Her beauty must not be disfigured, for surely her splendor deserves the devotion of her citizens. Amid all the horrors accompanying the Gothic War of the following century, the famous general, Belisarius, also dwells upon Rome's splendor. His words fittingly correct the impression that Rome, after the fall of the Western Empire, was a mere mound of wrecked classical remains. When begging the Gothic king, Totila, to spare the city, Belisarius writes as follows. Many centuries have conspired to create the monuments in which thou now seest her decked. Many emperors and the best architects and artists in the world have labored through long ages at this work. Rome is thus a memorial of all the talent and genius of antiquity. That Rome in the 6th century remained in a good state of preservation and could afford to ignore such losses as she had experienced, surrounded as she still was by the wealth and grandeur of the monuments yet standing, appears also from the enthusiastic description left us by Cassiodorus. Writing at the beginning of the century, Cassiodorus, prime minister of the Ostrogothic kingdom and the last Roman statesman, in a document drawn up at Rome in dealing with the appointment of an architectus publicorum and addressed in his sovereign's name to the city prefect, says, "The ancients reckoned 7 wonders of the world, but these are all surpassed by the marvelous spectacle which this unique city offers. We can truly say Rome is one great wonder." Cassiodorus also impresses upon this architect that he must watch over that marvelous forest of buildings, as he calls it, with the utmost care. "The lofty walls," he says, "rest upon slender columns, seemingly cast in wax, so perfect are their proportions, so slight their supports. The stones of the walls are so admirably fit that the whole mass seems to have sprung up spontaneously. Moreover, antiquity has, so to speak, peopled this whole city with statues. Life is infused into the stone and bronze figures, giving them the likeness of real human beings." He ends with a poetic touch. "Thou seest the sculptured chargers, snorting with dilated nostrils, impatient to break away." In another decree, the eloquent statesman and scholar speaks of the surprising number of horses in stone and bronze scattered about the city of his day. In such a place, he exclaims, "No guard should be needed. Respect and admiration should suffice to shield the beauty of Rome." Elsewhere, he gives a description, wonderfully clear in spite of its verbosity, of the aqueducts, whose lofty hill-like arches still bring copious streams of water into the city. He depicts the still undamaged public fountains, which refresh and enliven the aspect of the city, the Naumachiae forming regular lakes inside the city, and the luxuriously appointed thermae or public baths, the Circus Maximus, with its 2 towering obelisks, and various decorative buildings. Lastly, he comes to the magnificent Sacra Via, leading to the Forum, where the ancient and already tottering brazen elephants attract his attention. The Greek, Procopius of Caesarea, whom we have already named, writing a trifle after Cassiodorus, singles out a few specially famous statues and monuments, which were then in perfect preservation. His statements confirm what we have said and prove that Rome, in the main, was but little changed. Myron's famous cow he found still standing in the Forum of Peace, likewise the valuable brazen bull which adorned one of the fountains, which he took to be a work of Phididias or of Lysippus. He states that works of both masters were standing there, and that the name of Phidias was clearly legible under one statue. To Procopius, it was also given to admire the legendary vessel of Aeneas, that memorial of the city's remotest history, which was treasured in the public place, or Navale, near the Tiber. He attests that the bronze double-faced statue of Janus, some 5 ells in height, was still preserved in the undamaged, brass-covered temple of that god on the Roman Forum. He adds that, during the wars of his day, it had occurred to certain unknown Romans to open, according to heathen custom, the brazen gates of this temple, but that they had been obliged to break them, in which they had, however, been only partially successful. From this it would seem that Rome and her classic buildings had to experience occasional damage from pagans. The list of monuments whose existence at that date proves that the city and even its ornaments had been preserved might be lengthened by adducing the results of recent excavations and the Roman records of the numerous buildings and ancient monuments still standing in the 15th and 16th centuries. One remarkable find during the pontificate of Sixtus IV deserves, however, to be mentioned. When the chief shrine of Hercules, the Ara Maxima, at the end of the Circus Maximus, not far from Santa Maria in Cosmenden, was laid bare, the whole lower part was found partially uninjured. The bronze gilt statue of the god was still there. All the memorial inscriptions relating to the sacrifices annually offered by the city prefects were also in their place. The structure had therefore been spared by the German barbarians and allowed to stand unharmed throughout the Middle Ages. End of section 18. Section 19 of History of Rome and the Popes in the Middle Ages, Volume 1, by Hartmann Grisar. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. Chapter 4. Rome at the Inception of the Germanic and Romance Medieval World. Part 4. Persistence of classical life in Rome after the fall of the empire. At the period with which we are now occupied, about the end of the 5th and beginning of the 6th century, many facts attest that the old classical life was by no means dead in the city. Actual idolatry and its adjuncts had indeed been set aside, but ancient habits continued to prevail, and, both in public and in private life, Rome bore the stamp of classical times. "This city," exclaims a contemporary, whose words, in spite of the evil days in which Rome had fallen, remain for a long time appropriate. "This city is the stronghold of justice, the home of the fine arts, a palace of dignities. She is the summit of the whole world, and the motherland of freedom," that is, freedom in its old Roman sense. "None are reckoned foreigners in this city, but those who choose to remain barbarians, or whom slavery deprives of her benefits." These words are addressed to a noble Gaul of ancient lineage, whom Sidonius is inviting to come to Rome and take service at the Roman court, instead of remaining at home in his country seat surrounded by barbarians. Let us suppose that he really started off with his Gaelic or Germanic retinue, and that the visitors were totally unacquainted with Roman life and manners. What a contrast this city and its inhabitants would furnish to their surroundings at home! In what follows, we shall give a few details, such as may be found in abundance in the writers of the period. Let the reader regard them as they would have been regarded by those travelers to whom classical life was something absolutely novel. It may even be new to some people of our own day to find how pertinaciously certain customs of early times had remained rooted at Rome, whilst elsewhere the whole aspect of the world had been transformed. Beginning with that focus of the life of ancient Rome, we find that the Thermae are still thronged. Attendance at the bath constitutes a regular feature of social life, though well-conducted Christians do not frequent all the baths indiscriminately. We know, for instance, that Consentius, a friend of Sidonius, was wont to visit those only where privacy protects Christian modesty. These he prefers to the Thermae which Nero and Agrippa bestowed upon the city, and which the emperor, whose bust adorns Salona, that is Diocletian, bequeathed to the citizens. These vast imperial baths were therefore still used by the Romans for refreshment and conversation. With reference to the circus games, we learn that the four racing colors, white, blue, green, and red, still excited the populace as much as the ancient combats. The thousands interested in these sports were divided into camps according to the party they supported. The brilliant festivities of the circus were still often interrupted by the clamor of the people for bread. If from the earliest days the interior of the amphitheater and circus had been classic ground for that classic cry, it now rang out more and more strongly as privation became keener in the oft-besieged and sacked city of Rome. It was still, as of yore, the business of the prefect of the Annona and of the city prefect to supply the city with food. King Theodoric, after making an end of Odovacar's power, assumed, according to the ancient custom, this responsibility. Belonging to Theodoric's reign, we have a very detailed, in fact almost diffuse, edict re-establishing the Praefectus Annonae of ancient times for the period of the Gothic domination. The decree informs the prefect that he must be diligent in meeting the necessities of the most holy city. Sacratissima herbs. It carefully explains for his benefit that though Ceres discovered corn, it was Pan who first made it into bread, whence the Latin word panis. This verbose document, like many others, issued by the Gothic government, was drafted by the learned classical scholar Cassiodorus. Among the ancient showplaces of Rome, the Capitol and the Forum Romanum would attract a stranger as forcibly as the circus delighted the Romans. Public life was still carried on there as of old. There we might see ambassadors from distant climes, high officers of state, and merchants with costly foreign wares. "To ascend the heights of the Capitol," writes Cassiodorus, "is to grasp how human genius can outdo itself." And when he said this, the temple of Jupiter, the chief glory of the Mons Capitolinus, had already been unmercifully damaged by the Vandals. Though the golden roof was wanting to this building, yet his words proved that as yet there were no ruins on the hill of the Capitol. Within the precincts of the Capitoline temple, business was still actively transacted. Itinerant merchants displayed their stuffs for sale. Rich trinkets and jewels from afar flashed in the sun, and there too Sidonius saw the richly carved tables of the money changers, or trapezitae, with their golden burden. How loftily the ancient citadel of the Capitol, or Arx, must have looked down upon all this traffic. Sidonius also gives us an interesting description of a judicial session held by the Senate in its ancient hall of assembly, or curia, close by the Capitol. All is carried on with classic solemnity, the sacrifices to the gods being the only item omitted. The Senate, as the most venerable corporation of the empire, continued to issue its decrees in the old style. As of old, they were engraved on marble, Roman custom insisting on this solemn, monumental mode of promulgation. An incidental allusion of Sidonius stands to remind us that, even in his time, public documents of permanent importance, graven on stone or metal, were published either at the Capitol or the ancient rostra. During the 4th century, and probably even later, the edicts of the city prefect were usually placed on marble tablets in the Portus Thermarium Traianarum. This was a hall close to his official offices, between the Temple of Tellus and the Baths, or Thermae, of Titus and Trajan, near the Church of St. Peter ad Vincula. The buildings of the prefecture can still be traced with tolerable certainty, and a good many of the inscriptions have also been recovered. On the other hand, an edict concerning the clergy, engraved on marble, was put up by the Gothic king Athalaric in the atrium of St. Peter's near the Vatican and at other churches. From the sparse notices of contemporaries, we can cull some details concerning the manner of life of the rich and stately senators in their luxurious palaces. Draped in flowing mantle, edged with crimson or purple stripes, or trabiae, they recline upon curule chairs, inlaid with ivory, surrounded by the images of their ancestors. The walls of their halls are decorated with pompous inscriptions, or fasti, in colors and gold, setting forth their titles and achievements. Nor may they show themselves abroad, save in costly and rich decorated litters. Citizens of note joined in all the festivities of the imperial court. The official epithalamium, or nuptial ode, to the reigning emperor on the occasion of his marriage was an important detail of the ceremony. When Ricimer married the emperor's daughter, ancient hymeneal songs were to be heard on all sides. The Thalassio Fescennius, says an eyewitness, re-echoed through the theaters, marketplaces, praetorium, forums, temples, and gymnasia. The streets are still gay with the varied costumes of antiquity, magistrates and grandees especially, holding firmly to the traditional fashions, though the great influx of foreigners, and especially intercourse with Byzantines and Germans, have already somewhat modified the ordinary dress. The tunica talaris and manicotta, that is, with sleeves, or even the dalmatia, are everywhere in use by both men and women. The toga, formerly worn over it by men, and the analogous stola, worn by women, has been replaced among the lower orders by the planetia or pinula. On the accompanying revio from the Arch of Constantine, we may see this planetia, from which was derived the ecclesiastical chasuble. The five common people appearing right and left on each side are clad in it, likewise the two candle bearers. The others all wear the folded toga, or toga contabulata. Matrons still dress in the ancient palla, a sort of pallium, which often covered the head, as is the case with the two figures in the mosaic at St. Sabina's. On official occasions, the senators appeared in a specially rich toga, and this classic garment remained the usual dress at court, unless people of very high rank preferred to wear the chlamys, a guard of which the character was military rather than civil. A border toga was the distinctive dress of the city prefect. According to Cassiodorus, this was the vestis Romulae, by which the prefect sums up in himself all that is Roman. Consuls wore the toga picta. We may thus see them portrayed upon their ivory diptychs. It was yet in use at the time of Cassiodorus. The ancient robe of the triumphator still decked the consul with its rich drapery. The consul also received the staff surmounted by an eagle or a cross, or Victorialis Scipio. When performing his duties, he was also shod in gold-embroidered shoes. He sat in a curule chair on a high dais, or tensa. As in past ages, he was preceded by lictors with their fasces. To these sketches of public and private life, we may add a few words on the fortunes of the whilom all-powerful consular dignity. Its fate aptly expresses the fate of Rome. In the 5th century, consuls had already lost most of their importance. It is, nevertheless, always mentioned as an event of great consequence that at the circus games, they started the chariot races by throwing down the traditional kerchief, or mappa. They are even shown on the diptychs with the mappa in their hand, a precious testimony to the decay of their office. The last consul ordinarius nominated in the Roman Empire was Flavius Ancilius Faustus Albinus Basilius in the year 541. To avoid the long string of names, another instance of the bad taste of the times, he is usually referred to as Flavius Basilius Jr. The year in question was dated by the name of Basilius Jr., according to the ancient custom of reckoning by consulships. The subsequent years, from 542 to 565, are, however, followed by the formula. After the consulship of Basilius, there being no longer any ordinary consul, the only consul is the now consul perpetuus, and he is always the reigning emperor of Eastern Rome. His deeds bear the year both of his reign and of his consulship. The maintenance, however, of the external form of the Roman consulship, even in Byzantium, proves the respect and veneration with which the very name of the eternal city of Rome was cherished. The belief in Rome as the queen of the universe was too deeply rooted to be set aside at once. In conclusion, let us listen to two voices, both of which set forth the general impression produced by Rome in the 5th and 6th centuries, one that of a pagan poet, the other that of a saintly Christian. Claudius Rutilius, the heathen city prefect of the year 417, quitted Rome to return to his home in Gaul. This representative of northern feeling had experienced the same vivid impressions on being brought into contact with the city as so many other visitors from the dominions of the new nations. In his poem on the return journey, he expresses his feelings with all the glowing imagery of paganism. From the ship, his glance travels up the Tiber to the city, and deeply moved by the last sight of her gorgeous beauty, he addresses her in passionate farewell. "Hear me, O Roma, thou loveliest queen of the world, thou who sittest enthroned among the constellations of heaven. Hear me, O mother of men, O mother of the gods, whose temples tower towards the skies." And he then breaks forth into a rhetorical prayer to the goddess Roma, as well as to Mars and Venus, from whom he traces her descent. Rome's beauty presented itself under a different aspect to the noble and gifted soul of the African Fulgentius of Ruspe. He had previously been a high functionary in the Vandal kingdom, and in 500 found himself for the first time on Roman soil. Beneath the humble garb he had voluntarily assumed, he retained a heart in sympathy with all that was grand and beautiful. This is proved by his writings when he had become Bishop of Ruspe and a much respected father of the church. On his visit to the Eternal City, he sought out all it contained of interest, though with a special predilection for its religious memories and monuments. Nor did he neglect the silent palaces, where high senatorial families, with whom he was acquainted, and who shared his views, led the life of monks. Together with the African monks who accompanied him, he joined the crowd assembled in the forum for some great civic festival. With pensive admiration, he gazed at the magnificent buildings, the basilicas, temples, triumphal arches, and memorials of mighty deeds with which this site abounded, and then on the gorgeous spectacle of the pageant. As the old contemporary biography of the saint observes, his thoughts rose above the vain pomp of earthly show. Turning to his companions, he cried, "If earthly Rome glows before us in such splendor, what must be the beauty of the heavenly Jerusalem? And if mortals are surrounded with so much grace and dignity, what glories must await in their heavenly homes, the elect? Those who have despised the fleeting glamour of this world for the sake of Christ and of his brethren." End of section 19.
Fall into big savings, all in the Kroger app. Buy two, get two free on 12 packs of delicious Coca-Cola, Pepsi, or 7-Up with your card. Then get 3-pound packs of flavorful 80% lean ground beef for $2.99 a pound with your card and a digital coupon. Shop these deals at your local Kroger, less than 5 miles away. Or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.